Hey, it's E.B. Moss, and this is episode 2 of season 2 of Insider Interviews, where you get the insider scoop on the business of media, marketing, and advertising, with a human touch from the people at the top of their game. This episode, we're going to get the insights from one of the best in the brand business, Mary Baglivo. We're going to talk about brand love, brand purpose, career hindsight, and advice for the future, especially for women, from someone who's been president or in the C-suite at some of the world's biggest advertising firms, including Arnold, J. Walter Thompson, Saatchi & Saatchi, and others. Mary went on to be a marketing force in the education vertical at Northwestern, Pace, and our alma mater, Rutgers. Mary was crystal clear in a lot of ways. Here we go. Mary, it's great to see you.
And it's fabulous to see you, Evie. I'm so happy to be here.
You know, this is such a sort of odd experience for me because you're sitting at my dining room table instead of sitting in a dorm room with me the way I remember you. So I really want to thank you for being here. And I want to start our conversation off with some of the basics, like 101 when we were at Rutgers. I want to look at what is a brand and what are some of the things that the marketing industry is really grappling with now. So what's your definition, Mary?
You know, defining a brand is something that I think is really challenging to do. And there's so many words. And I remember spending so many years as a brand marketing practitioner with different platforms and models and temples and, you know, debating the words. And so I don't know that specific language matters so much, but I do believe that understanding your brand and clarifying your brand is super, super important. Probably the best way to describe a brand to me is a promise to your constituents, to your consumers. It's more than the product attributes, obviously. It's more than what it looks like. It's certainly more than what an influencer or someone who might be a promoter of a brand portrays. It's definitely got to be emotional. Mm. And it probably has to involve all the senses in some way, shape, or form. Mm.
And is that different from brand identity, or do all those attributes come together to make a brand identity? I get really confused with brand promise, brand identity, brand values.
Me too. And I don't mean to be negative about people who spend their time trying to help guide clients and startup founders, et cetera, through the discipline of determining the difference between a brand promise and, but you know what, I don't really see the differences either. But usually a brand identity is synonymous with something visual. So we normally would say brand identity and design for sort of the visual portrayal, the logo, the visual elements of a brand.
Oh, good. I'm a cooler, smarter person now. So thank you. So what are the first couple of things that you have to consider in building a brand for your company?
You know, I would say today it's as important as ever to just listen to your consumers, to your customers. And there are those who say that today consumers create the brand themselves. And maybe there's some of that, but I think it's really important for the brand owner, with the input, listening very carefully to the consumer and their needs, start with that. Like, what's relevant, what's interesting, what's convincing, what's the gap, what do they want, what do they love? Uh-huh. About your product, and start there.
And there are a lot of ways to listen these days, so that can be pretty overwhelming, I'm sure.
Absolutely, and it's, you know, 24/7 if you want to. That's very different than the olden days when I started back in the business, when you gathered consumers and you ran research in a very organized way. It wasn't, you know, a fluid, ongoing thing like it is now.
Mm-hmm. I do want to be careful, since we're peers, to not reference our coming of age era as the olden days. Mm. But okay.
The golden days?
Oh no, we're golden girls. It's true. Oh. You know, I was asked to write a website recently for an established but still a fairly niche company, and I was really surprised. They'd been in business for a few years that they'd asked me to write their mission statement. Now, to me, that's something that you craft when you're actually starting your business, but can a mission change as a brand evolves?
Well, I hope that they were just asking you to help them articulate their purpose better. But if they were actually asking you to create or develop or evolve their purpose for them, that would set off an alarm bell for me. Yeah. Because at the very core of a brand, of a business, is that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll go with I needed to articulate it for them. Yeah, I love that. Gives me props too. All right. So we have listened to our customers. We've identified our brand values. Let's get into what you do so well, developing a brand marketing campaign. What are the elements that go into a brand marketing campaign?
Everything and everything. Everything right now, you know. And honestly, because as you referenced in the intro, I've spent the last chunk of my career working in higher education institutions and with museums and foundations, more purposeful products by definition, not to disparage all the years of selling credit cards and cars and ketchup and cereal. I am not the most adept right now at all the elements or tools in the toolkit and the playbook, because it's vast.
It's overwhelming.
It's vast and overwhelming. So really start with just really making sure that our story, our promise is articulated beautifully and is able and in form fit to move across all the owned, earned, and paid channels. So the importance of brevity, the importance of audio, video, the still image, mm-hmm. because finding your digital playbook, your audio playbook, it's just so vast. And every brand is different, right? So I can't really put a recipe out there.
That's a good way to put it. And, you know, omnichannel is such a buzzword these days, and consistency in having to be everywhere the consumer is and every format and iterate your message and Well, let's focus a little bit now on brand purpose. Because we started out talking about brand values, and now that you found your calling in marketing higher education, I'm guessing that brand purpose is something that you can speak to pretty well. There's something that brands and companies have to be really cognizant of, for example, and I'm going to call it brand washing. So, Mary, how do you establish what your brand purpose is and communicate that with respect, authenticity, as Oprah might say?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I also, at the same time I sit in educational and art forums, I also am a director on three public companies boards in much more typical, if you will, businesses. So real estate, restaurants, shopping malls, hotels, right? Things like that. So their purpose and care and meaningful contributions to the community, to its employees, to the environment. I mean, ESG is the biggest, I don't want to say buzzword because I think it's important, but I probably spend more time in the boardroom disproportionately talking about ESG now than certain financial elements, which is a really good thing. But how to express your care and concern in a way that doesn't seem superficial and just for the credit check, I think has to come from, again, your internal constituents. And that's where my companies and my organizations are finding their fuel. And it's what their employees care about and where they can do meaningful work and things that people can actually put their hands on and touch. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you have reality in your people, because I think people are at the essence of every business, forget what the product is, that's where it kind of comes from. So yeah, I see a lot of actually sincere, authentic work in diversity, equity, and inclusion, environmental and sustainability and other kinds of community service work really actually being done in company. And that gives you something to express. That's sincere and believable.
Good. So there's definitely something to doing well by doing good.
Absolutely.
And probably especially these days with all of the competition for share of mind and balancing that whole brand and demand situation. And I want to talk a little bit about that. You know, I came from a publication that focused on the difference between creating demand and the top of the funnel, so to speak, or awareness. Where does brand purpose fit into that? Can you do a demand campaign or an ROI campaign when you're focused on brand purpose?
Good question. I would imagine there are certain brands and businesses where brand purpose and brand benefit or promise is the most salient and relevant driver of the business. There are some, not many probably, but there are some, I think. And I think as the consumer and the employee continues to demand and care deeply about what a company does, that we'll see more and more brands where it's not an and, it just is. It's woven integrally into the promise of the brand. Well, even in the apparel business where I spent 14 years on the board of a company called PVH, which the consumer brands are Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger. In the later years of that experience, every product in the most recent Tommy fashion launch year had something meaningful that had to do with sustainability. Mm. And they didn't need to do all that, right? And the reason I'm saying that every single product, they're driven by business, right? They are driven by what they can sell to their customers. And the customer was wanting, was desiring, was caring about whether it was, you know, water-free washed jeans,
yeah,
or, you know, a better quality organic cotton, not sourced from China, mm-hmm, that kind of thing. And so it was real. It was starting to synthesize and combine that desire to do something good, to get credit as a good company, with actually what consumers were wanting to buy. So, you know, even as something as material, mm-hmm, and commercial and ephemeral as the fashion business, you're starting to see it in a very meaningful way.
You know, I talk about this podcast as humanizing executives and adding that personal touch. And I've heard recently that some people are having problems with the phrase personal brand. I don't know what you think as a human executive, but wouldn't you say that people can exhibit qualities that are consistent with values? I think that's your personal brand. Do you have an opinion on that phrase?
I agree with you. I mean, it sounds a little, you know, self-centered or, you know.
I'm a brand.
But on the other hand, I think it's really important for leaders to think hard about how they lead, about how they work with people, because that's all you got, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so I think if that exercise matches up in people's minds to articulating what is your personal brand, that's fine, because the meaningful work is figuring out what's important and how to be a good leader. I had an amazing conversation with a very successful Silicon Valley female founder who's sold several companies very successfully, does great work at Stanford, really amazing. And she believes that the essence, the most very important thing in her success story is listening to people and as a leader, seeing the individual strengths of the members of the team so that she could get all these diverse ideas, which leads to better outcomes, but in addition, coach people up on their strengths versus trying to turn everybody into the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. And that to me sounds like branding, right? Find what is unique, what are the unique and, you know, distinctive attributes of a brand? And so it is branding, but it's not for superficial reasons. It's, yeah, for good reasons, I think.
You know, I intentionally wanted to have you and Yarl Mohn as my first two episodes of season two of Insider Interviews for your 2020 hindsight as former CEOs. But the other thing that you have in common is you both emphasize listening to employees. I worked with Yarl when he ran E, which he founded, and every single day he would walk the halls and chat with employees and check in with them. And then he did the same thing when he was CEO of NPR. He even got on planes and drove cross country to chat with employees at outskirt member stations. So I think when you talk about the tech leader, the common theme with that is listening to employees and coaching them. And not only did she get good advice, but she helped grow them as well.
Oh, absolutely. And when you spend time as a CEO with your most senior people, your direct reports, a great piece of advice I once got was just ask them about them. How are you? How are you doing? How's your family? How are you getting enough exercise? How are you sleeping? It sounds silly, but you know, there's many, many, many ways to find out how their work is going, how their businesses are doing. There's all sorts of financial metrics and wizards to tell you that, and all sorts of KPIs. Having said that, the people at the essence of making this stuff happen have to be in good shape, have to be happy, have to be nourished intellectually. And so that's kind of the key job of a CEO, is to make sure that the people are feeling good and feeling happy and feeling pumped up and are, you know, having opportunities to learn and grow and contribute.
I love that, Mary. And this is probably why you were Phi Beta Kappa, and I was like Phi Phi Fo at Rutgers. I'm going to leave out the year that we were there together, as I alluded to earlier, because I do think that ageism is alive and well, especially for women in business. So calling up some of that leadership experience that you just shared with us, what happened after Rutgers? How did you pursue a career in marketing? What was your path, especially coming up in, yes, I'll acknowledge it, the 80s?
Sure, you just did. and that's fine. So I did not have great intentionality about a career. I used to do these kinds of interviews and panels and talk, you know, very proudly about how, gee whiz, was I glad that I got to go to Rutgers and be an English major and study philosophy and art history, etc. And I'm so glad that I didn't spend those precious years studying the marketing of consumer products, ketchup, because I had, I won't say how many years, but many years of that later. And then someone once admonished me, a younger person, and said, you know, for us, we don't have the privilege of, you know, marinating in liberal arts for 4 years because we have to go get a job fast. And in order to get a job, you got to have an internship, so you got to have a career path. So I still think, for me, learning how to think and synthesize and appreciate creativity wound up being huge. And I would not do that differently. Having said that, I have to be more respectful to people that don't have the same kind of privilege and timetable that I was lucky enough to have. So I thought I'd be a writer. I thought I'd be a journalist. I don't know. I, you know, went to New York and figured everybody wanted to hire me and they didn't. But I lucked into a job at an ad, big ad agency. And there, and now I'm sorry, but I have to kind of date us.
Okay.
I was typing for people, as were, you know, the guy next to me who went to Harvard, et cetera, et cetera. You got the picture. But
yeah,
gave me the opportunity to talk to people and learn a little about what they actually did there. And that turned me on, gave me the advertising, marketing, branding bug. And so I went to grad school at Northwestern. And that was very transformational for me, because there I learned the lexicon and the thinking around marketing. And I came out of that program and I chose to take a job, which was shocking to most people, in Chicago at an ad agency. And I did that for two reasons. One, they promised me that I could work on Procter & Gamble, which was, you know, the finishing school, you know, the golden age of marketing, Procter & Gamble. That was pre-big tech. And then I also was very, very attracted to the fact that this ad agency had a woman CEO. Now, this wound up being a very important thing for me, even though at first I just thought, wow, that's really, really great. And she was super charismatic and very, very successful. And I learned a lot just by watching. And it really established a fearlessness in me that a lot of my contemporaries didn't get the opportunity to have because they entered a much more traditional male dominant agency industry. I did not have that experience until years later when I went to J. Walter Thompson in the year 2000. But I didn't live that life. I didn't see it.
Wow. I love that. And Gina Davis would applaud you for living her mantra in trying to create equity in the media industry of if you can see it, you can be it. So you've talked about how you learned to mentor by listening to other people, and then you got mentored by observing someone else. Are you able to name names of this fabulous female CEO?
I will name a name, and then I will also say that really wasn't particularly mentoring as we know it today. It was observing and emulating. So I had a role model, perhaps not a mentor, and it was Charlotte Beers, mm-hmm. who later became the chairman and CEO of Ogilvy, and I wound up being the CEO of that agency that I joined out of grad school because one of the great things of her leadership, Charlotte's, was we were high growth mode. And if someone had the talent and the courage, she just gave the person the chance. And so I really had an accelerated path, and I was very, very fortunate in that sense. So I wind up being the CEO of that agency, which was acquired by the French, Euro RSCG, ultimately. Charlotte went on to the State Department, worked with Colin Powell. Unfortunately, 9/11 happened, and so being the brand czar at a time of great crisis in our country was really, really difficult. But her charisma and her leadership and her very insightful authenticity remains something I enjoy today.
Okay, two-parter. So first, looking back at your career through the lens as a female leader, Mary, what's changed? What hasn't changed enough? And then tell us how, I know you're on the board of the New York Women's Foundation, how is that supporting women these days?
Yeah, and every industry is different, you know. I grew up in the ad agency business, professional services business, lean margin business, right? Every day pitching to save your life, competing. So hence, I don't really blame the industry, but they really were pretty vacuous in terms of opportunities for thoughtful professional development and things like that. It's probably obvious the way I talk. I was never sent to a training program. I've never been to a management development program ever, not once ever. I just sort of became a CEO because I guess I was good at whatever I was doing before then. And unfortunately, that's how they did it. You're a great writer. You're a great producer. You're a great designer. All right, let's make you the creative director. What? So I became a CEO by default. But listen, I think people are more thoughtful, at least, and aware about issues of, you know, how women are treated. I think, and this kind of dovetails into New York Women's Foundation, which I'll get to in a minute, the work of, you know, Tarana Burke and Me Too and others have really put down a bit of a playbook, or at least either motivated and inspired companies to be better about the way people are treated and the way women and other people from disadvantaged categories from a business standpoint are treated and considered, hiring practices, workplace initiatives, all those things. So many companies truly care deeply and are doing the right stuff. Pay equity studies, that's the first thing I make sure any board I join for any company that they have that. But then there's some who just have now sort of like been pummeled into it, and that's okay too, because that's what investors ask of boards and CEOs now, and that's good that that's on the radar. A big part of ESG is not just the environment, right? It is social and governance and people issues, and so there's a certain accountability now, certainly in public companies, that I think has changed the game a lot. Is it still a fair and easy playing field? Oh no, there's so much sort of under the radar bias that still exists. And I guess, you know, one thing about getting to a certain point in your career is to try to be as courageous and fearless as you can be to help pave a clearer route for the people that are coming after. I mean, I look back now at things that I should have called out that I experienced personally.
Yes.
I won't get specific, but they were bad. And I didn't, and I regret that now. But I also understand why, when you're trying to build your career and support, I was the breadwinner for my family. I mean, it's scary,
at
right?
At the time, you could not risk.
It would be very courageous too. But I'd like to think that part of the reason I do the stuff I do now is to do that.
Yeah. So tell us some of that good stuff you're doing now. Tell us about the New York Women's Foundation and what does it do?
So it's so awesome. First of all, great, great work. It is the largest grantor to community-based organizations that do important work for women, children, and gender-fluid individuals in the New York area. Mm. And the philosophy is completely based in the fact that it's the people on the ground in the communities doing the hard work that have all the knowledge and all the expertise. And we, as funders, need to listen to them. And so we do participatory grant making. Our grantee partners are part of our boards and our committees. And it's a very inclusive way to run a foundation. Some of the famous work is around Me Too, early funders of Chinatown-based woman who tried to organize the restaurant and cleaning workers, the women of Chinatown community, mm-hmm. who were just invisible and had no protection, and did it so well with our support that now that's become a national movement, right? And there's things like that, but it's a lot of work around the families of an incarcerated people, very interesting work. Drug addiction and drug deaths and drug damage is such a big, massive problem. So contemporary, maybe radical community-based ways to help with some of that anti-domestic violence, that kind of work. As a brand, it is a phenomenal thing. Back to brands, their slogan or their brand line is radical generosity. Radical generosity, right? And I just think that is the promise of the organization that they live every day. Talk about badass women. I mean, it's incredible. It's the most diverse, interesting, brave bunch of badasses. Yeah. May 4th, our Radical Generosity Breakfast, which is probably the most epic event of the year for people who care about this stuff. And if you ever want to see 1,000 to 2,000 incredible women gathered to talk about the great work that they do. And just here's a little tiny executional example of give you a feel how this organization works. So here's our big get together, right? Big hoo-ha, the big fancy ballroom. And on the stage are the grantee partners, the people from the local communities in the Bronx and in Queens, et cetera, who do the work. And people like me who are on the board and our donors, et cetera, we're down low. We're watching them, right? And you get to hear their stories and their work. And it's very, very emotionally uplifting.
I know you get a lot of satisfaction for working with New York Women's Foundation, but also just say thank you. It's great what you're doing. And I will add to the show notes details about the May 4th event for New York Women's Foundation. So let's talk about what you're doing for business today. You're running the Baglivo Group in addition to sitting on many boards. Tell us about your own company now.
Well, My company, honestly, right now has one big full-time client.
Yay. And that, sometimes that's all you need.
And that is Pace University. And so I'm just doing that with the Baglivo Group right now. And that just kind of happened right before the pandemic. And I just got drawn into this incredible Herculean effort to save a university. And I had never worked in a university like Pace before, where it's very mission driven. It is about, I guess I'm into brand lines, but part of the reason that I was drawn to them is that their mission forever has been opportunitas. So they're about creating opportunity for students. It's majority first gen college students, organically diverse, and very, very interesting place. And so I spent a great deal of my time doing that. And then my public company corporate boards, I chair compensation committees at several of them, but also there are dedicated committees in these public company boards for corporate responsibility, ESG. So I know that sounds just structural and managerial, but to have a committee of a board of directors for Fortune 500 companies dedicated 100% to corporate social responsibility, ESG, DEAI, is saying something tangible.
Yeah, and I think you need the structure sometimes to be able to move things forward. So that's a great example. Now, to cite another common thread that you have with Jarl Mohn, you have taken advantage of those days studying art history. You sit on the board of the Block Museum, and Jarl is very much a supporter of the arts and actually just created a series of grants for unsupported artists in Los Angeles and supports the Hammer Museum. Tell us about the Block.
Yeah, I'm really proud of the Block. That's the Academic Art Museum at Northwestern. And I sit on their board of advisors, as you mentioned. The Block is really not just a museum that hangs beautiful work on its walls. In fact, sometimes we contemplate whether we ought to not call ourselves a museum. But because it's an academic art museum, everything we do is accessible and intertwined with the pedagogy and the curriculum for students and other academics. It's interdisciplinary. So right now, for instance, we're doing something that involves the engineering school, but mostly—
Art and engineering.
Art and engineering.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We also shy away from saying we just do social justice exhibitions because we'd rather say we tell untold stories. Mm. But every exhibition we put up that we create are there to address what we think is an important story that has been untold or undertold. So two that were very interesting in the past few years. One was called Caravans of Gold, which actually traveled to the Smithsonian Museum of African Art. And it was using fragments of gold and porcelain and things like that that have been found in sub-Saharan Africa and have been able to be traced to wealth in Europe and China to prove that certain countries in sub-Saharan Africa at one point in time were among maybe the most powerful, wealthy, prestigious countries on the planet. And why is that important? Well, we love history and we love stories, but the reason the Smithsonian wanted it so badly, and they kept it up for a long time, is because children, particularly Black children in this country, should hear a history that is inspiring and makes them proud. And so often they see transatlantic slave trade, and pretty much that's it. And that's important for them to understand too. But we thought this was really important work. And then the one that we just closed that was super meaningful was something called Site of Struggle. And this curator's work was, it's anti-Black violence protest art. So not imagery of the violence, but over many, many years, historically, the ways artists express their anger and their protest via art. Mm. And this thing was really, really powerful. So we helped the Montgomery Museum of Art in Alabama to get Avia Mellon to get a grant so it could move after it left the Block's premises to be on exhibit in Montgomery, Alabama. And think about that. That's pretty interesting. So we took a little trip as a board to visit Birmingham and Montgomery, and we saw our art, but more importantly, we saw Bryan Stevenson's Legacy Museum and the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church and the Rosa Parks Museum, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a very moving experience and very, very eye-opening, very meaningful. I probably said that already, but I would really encourage anyone who has the opportunity to go do that civil rights trip to do it, because wow.
So, yeah, again, here's that through line of listening and learning and sharing in order to help others learn through observation, and a through line of brand purpose and ESG. Awesome, Mary. And I love how this has come full circle for you also. And now that you're focused in higher education and all of your board work, do you feel a compunction to keep current on industry trends, or are you totally missing Web3 and all of its manifestations, or are you just relieved that you don't really have to know those details anymore?
Well, I love that you asked the last part of that question, because it gets me off the hook. I don't feel as compelled as I once may have to stay state of the art on, you know, marketing technology. But I have to say, I'm not a person that says, well, that's just unnecessary or secondary. I think it's really important, really interesting. I think that it is fascinating to see what AI can do. And, you know, I'm super curious about how a creative person in the industry, meaning the writers and the designers, the ones that like dream up things are so extraordinary. Really, it's amazing. People who come up with the famous ad campaigns, like, how do you think of this stuff? It's always been the great joy in the business for me, but how they use, you know, generators to
DALL-E.
It's fascinating, right? You say some words and see what comes up. And I think that that might be part of their creative process now. It's, and certainly in higher education, you know, there's all this agita about, you know,
papers written by AI.
Yes. And you, in my opinion, you cannot focus on trying to discipline it out or, you know, find ways to police it out of education. I think it's incumbent on educators to figure out how to make it useful and interesting. And so just little things, like I've seen professors flip the classroom. So for instance, have the students go home and do all the research they want using all these facilitators. But when it comes to writing, which is really important to be able to express, synthesize the data, the insight, and express your thoughts, do that in front of me. Do that live, you know, let me watch you write, right? So there's little things like that. And it's the luxury of this moment in time. I could say, don't want to really know about that. I think it's interesting, but I don't feel compelled. What I do feel compelled to stay current on and to proselytize a bit is things around leadership and people leadership and inclusive teams and how to be a good leader, because that just has to be taught.
Yeah.
It's really important.
Well, Mary Baglivo, I learned a lot. Thank you for teaching me, for teaching all of us some ways to think about what's happening in the world today and brand purpose and marketing and mad respect for women in leadership roles and all of the above, and even how to think about art a little bit differently.
Oh, it's so much fun. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for doing this.
Well, I hope you got some good insider scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. If you enjoyed this content, please feel free to buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/mossappeal. And I hope you'll follow Insider Interviews on social media and let me know if you have a question or a suggestion for a next stellar guest in media, marketing, and advertising. Speaking of stellar, my theme music was composed and performed by the incomparable Grammy-winning John Clayton. If I can help you with your company's podcast, please find me at mossappeal.com. Thanks again for listening.